We are so fortunate this morning in having Anne Baring with us, and she's going to give the first talk. I've known Anne now for many, many years. She was born in 1931. Is one allowed to say that? But it means that she is pre-war and therefore has very wide experience. Anne went up to St Hilda's in Cambridge, in Oxford. Of course, she should have gone to Cambridge, but she went to Oxford. And there she studied modern history. And I like the Oxford definition of modern history, anything after 1100, which I'd hardly call modern. And she, on leaving Oxford, she then went to the Far East for 2 years, where she got a good understanding of Far Eastern religions, and then she came back to this country. She's written 8 books, which is a massive achievement, and all her books are absolutely splendid, and I would recommend that you should have a little part of your bookcase reserved for Anne's books. And Anne, as you know, has just written another book, which is called The Dream of the Cosmos. It's an absolutely magnificent one. I think I'd be right in saying that this is really a compilation of Anne's work throughout her life. It's an astonishing book. So I hope you'll all go away with a copy tucked under your arm. And the network, as you know, has a book prize competition. And Anne's book has been awarded the 2013 Network Book Prize. So I'd ask Anne to come up and get the certificate, which is given to her, having won the Network Book Prize. Thank you, Anne. Do you want to say just a few words?
I just want to say a few words. For those of you who are new here for the first time, it's a most fantastic organization. It's been absolute lifeblood to me for 20, or I would say 30 years. I've known David 30 years?
Getting on for that.
And it's really enriched my life enormously, and my book actually owes a huge amount to the network. So I would recommend everyone to join up, get friends. Get going.
To bring other members
into it. Yes, absolutely. So I'll get on with my talk now. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
So,
Anne is now going to give her inaugural lecture after the book prize, and it's called The Dream of the Cosmos.
Now, David asked me to address the cultural and spiritual aspects of envisioning and embodying a new world. The first part of my talk is going to be dealing with the dark side, and the last part with the lighter side. But the dark side is pretty heavy, and I think you'll just have to sit through it as best you can. So this wonderful quote, redeem the time, redeem the unread vision in the higher dream. The higher dream is the dream of the cosmos. It's the hope of the cosmos in that sense. Dream in that sense. It's not a fantasy. It's an actual longing that we should wake up and reconnect with the cosmos. We exist on a tiny planet, in a cosmos of mind-blowing immensity and extraordinary beauty. So what might be its dream? And what might be the unread vision in the higher dream? Through the infinitesimal spark of cosmic light that is our human consciousness, the universe is revealing the complexity and splendor of its evolutionary journey. We are now aware of our evolutionary history and our origins in the cosmos. But are we aware that the universe has an inner life as well as a material form, and that this inner life or soul is the eternal ground of our own consciousness? We're living at a time of momentous evolutionary change, which demands the breakdown of old structures and the birth of a new worldview. The scientific discoveries of the last 100 years, the thrilling expansion of our knowledge of the universe, of the subatomic world, of the geological formation of the Earth, and the neurophysiology of the brain, all these have shattered the foundation upon which our culture was built, just as the discoveries of Copernicus shattered the medieval view of reality. In all these great discoveries, it's as if the universe, through our awakening consciousness, is coming to awareness of itself on this planet and looking back in wonder at its own evolutionary history. Yet we cling to the belief that we can master and exploit the Earth's resources for the sole advantage of our species, that science can bend nature to its will, that technological progress will bring all that we need and desire. In these beliefs, I think we are quite simply deranged. Now, this is just an overview of what I've known or experienced in my life. First of all, there was the Second World War, which started when I was 8, and the Holocaust at the end of it, the splitting of the atom and the bombing of Hiroshima, the Cold War and the fear of a nuclear winter, the extraordinary first view of the Earth from space, which changed our whole consciousness, the rise of the environmental movement, and Hubble's staggering discoveries that reveal the size and beauty of the universe, and for me personally, the many accounts of the near-death experience, which I found fascinating because I had one myself when I was 11 years old. So the radical social changes, I think, are contraception and the emancipation of women, the weakening of Christianity and the rise of a secular society, the tripling of the human population since 1945, which anyone who was driving yesterday will have felt the impact of that, and the digital revolution and the World Wide Web, and finally climate change and the conflicts over diminishing resources, which is growing ever stronger, and the rise of the Islamist threat now and the new ideology which is gripping the whole Muslim world. So we live in a time when the highest value, the image of God that held society together, is dying. It's been dying for about 200 years very slowly. The churches are weakened and irrelevant, still quarrelling about whether to admit women priests, and tainted by the appalling sexual abuse of children. In a predominantly secular society, there are no maps, no guides, no rituals that connect us to anything beyond ourselves. For many, the worship of the rational mind has replaced the worship of God, excluding any awareness of a deeper ground of consciousness or the primordial drives which still control us. And this creates a situation of great danger, a danger of our being overwhelmed and destroyed by what we have ignored or dismissed as irrelevant. Yet events are pressurizing us to question all our beliefs and our habits of behavior. It is as if during the last 100 years or so since the First World War, we've been placed in an alchemical retort and have been forced to live through the fire of transformation, for the most part unconsciously and with horrendous suffering. When you think of all those young men who died in the First World War and the Second, and I've got a wonderful poem with me which I'd like to read perhaps tonight if I can get through it without crying. There are three powerful beliefs that have formed our culture. One is the belief in the patriarchal religions that God is transcendent to ourselves, as it were outside the creative order of life on this planet, not present as divine spirit within it and within ourselves. The second is the Christian belief that we are a fallen, sinful species that could only be redeemed by the sacrificial death of the Son of God. And the third is the belief of reductionist science that we are the only conscious beings in a lifeless universe that is without consciousness, meaning, or purpose. Matter is the only reality. Consciousness begins and ends with the physical brain. There is no transcendent purpose or meaning to our lives. And this is what children are being taught in our schools, which I think is utterly, utterly appalling. Speaking for myself, I am someone who likes to explore and to go beyond the boundaries of the known. I do not like to have the horizon of exploration blocked by beliefs which limit my freedom to discover. I agree with Erwin Schrödinger when he said, I consider science an integrating part of our endeavour to answer the one great philosophical question which embraces all others, the one that Plotinus expressed by his brief, "Who are we?" And more than that, I consider this not only one of the tasks, but the task of science, and the only one that really counts. I think this is not only the task of science, but of religion as well, and one which is just not answered. So one of the great questions that invites an answer, and urgently, is do we look out on a dead universe or on a living one? There you have Brian Cox looking out on the universe. My favourite picture. So that's a question. I don't know what you believe, but I believe we live in a living universe. And I put this beautiful quote from Einstein: "The most beautiful experience we can have is the mysterious. It is the source of all true art and all science. He to whom this emotion is a stranger, who can no longer pause to wonder and stand rapt in awe, is as good as dead." Now here's something I've concocted. I love this technology. It's my creative work, really, putting it all together. We've devised three methods for connecting our consciousness with the greater consciousness of the universe. The first, on the right, is the method of religion, with its emphasis on belief and faith, originally initiated by a great teacher, but rapidly institutionalized. At its inception as revelation, it is more connected, I think, with right hemispheric consciousness, hence the RH by the side of religion. The second method is that of science and its quest to discover the laws of nature. In its methodology, it is more of a left hemispheric consciousness. And the third method is the direct path, indicated by the dotted yellow line, taken by visionaries, mystics, and shamanic cultures who seek a direct relationship with and a revelation of what is beyond the comprehension of the ordinary mind. There is tension, or has been, between science and religion, but I don't think this needs to be so, because both are attempting to answer Schrödinger's question, "Who are we?" I would like now to run fairly quickly through our programming during the last 4,000 years. You'll just have to come with me. In my book, you'll have to read my book because it goes through this in detail. In my book, I've called this expanse of time the solar era and have said that the linear thinking that characterizes or develops in this era has created most of the problems that we face today. First of all, in Judeo-Christian culture from around 2500 BC and in Islamic culture after the 7th century AD, this era is dominated by a monotheistic and paternal image of deity. There is no feminine dimension of the divine. All earlier gods and goddesses, temples and rituals of worship were ruthlessly eliminated by all three religions. Secondly, this 4,000-year-long era is dominated and shaped by two very powerful myths. The first is the battle between light and darkness, or good and evil, tremendously powerful myth originating with Zoroaster, probably during the second millennium BC. And it endures right up to our present day and the war against the axis of evil. They're reflected in this image of the hero fighting a dragon, which has been illustrated millions of times right the way through this era. This mythology has led ultimately, I think, to the battle to conquer and subdue nature in the service of man, because nature originally was seen as the dragon, and that dragon idea has been carried forward into science without it being aware of it. Now, the second myth is the story of the fall of man, as told in the book of Genesis, and the expulsion of our primal ancestors, Adam and Eve, from the Garden of Eden. In this myth, as you know, man was given dominion over the animals, and that's another aspect which has entered into science without it being aware of it, I think. Now, I come to the most important part of this part of the lecture, which is the effects of this polarizing mythology. The feminine archetype associated with nature, soul, body, and matter was split off from spirit. Thinking was dissociated from feeling and mind from soul. Nature and the earth were no longer sacred, and nature was effectively de-souled. Man was identified with spirit. Don't ask me how this happened, it just did. And a woman was identified with nature. She really was, right beginning with the Greeks. Woman became subject to man and gave rise to the misogyny that still afflicts us today. Body was split off from mind, and sexuality was believed to transmit the sin of the fall, so that if you were sleeping with your wife or husband, you were transmitting the sin of the fall. And children were tainted with that from the time they were born, and they took on the sin of Adam. Unbelievable to us today, but still believed by some Christians. So, the result of all this is that we carry within our psyche two different layers or kinds of consciousness, two different ways of knowing. The first I call the lunar kind, which belongs to about 25,000 years before the solar era, when the primordial soul, or the matrix of consciousness, which was where we had evolved out of nature, so to speak, developed. And it was a very ancient, instinctive, participatory and relational way of knowing, mediated through instinct, sensory observation, intuition, and possibly the right hemisphere of the brain. And it's mainly unconscious now in us, but is still found in shamanic cultures. And secondly, the solar kind of consciousness, which led to the rational mind, developing between 2000 BC and 2000 AD. And this has been a goal-focused kind of consciousness, mediated through linear thinking, and I think the left hemisphere. It's not exclusively, I'm making very general, great generalizations here. So what happened was that a radical imbalance developed in us as the solar way of knowing was literally superimposed and kind of squashing the older lunar way. It really did oppress the lunar way of thinking. Only the solar way was allowed to be maintained. So the left hemisphere has gradually become dominant, and we've lost all awareness of the sacredness of the life of the earth and the cosmos. I'm not saying that the lunar kind of consciousness never developed left hemispheric thinking, only that it was not dominant as it became during the solar era. Our most urgent task today is to heal the split between them and reconnect our conscious rational mind with the deeper layers of the psyche, what Jung called the unconscious, which is not unconscious at all. It's an unfortunate word. I'm coming to that later on. So, I'm coming now to the Book of Revelation and the wonderful engraving by Gustave Doré, which speaks of a woman standing on the moon with her head encircled by 12 stars. Can you see her up at the top there with 12 stars? And the angels in between, but underneath is this great dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns. Applied to our own time, we might intuitively sense that the cosmos is sending us a wake-up call, asking us to give birth to a new consciousness, one where the feminine value is honoured and where it is recognised that we live within a sacred cosmic order. It seems likely that the same attempt was made at the time of Christ, when he introduced values that were totally at variance with the beliefs and social customs of his time. But 2,000 years have passed and we're now entering a new eon. And as far as the world of governments, giant corporations and arms sales to corrupt regimes is concerned, it's business as usual. There was a shipment of arms from the US to Egypt about 3 weeks ago to that corrupt regime in Egypt. And it just goes on the same. We are still fixated in the old paradigm of power and conquest and domination. And perhaps if we understood why these old habits persist, we might have better results. So I'm going to take a look at the image of the dragon. I hope it will make you laugh. It always makes my friend Scylla laugh. She loves the dragon. So the dragon is an image of the immense power of the instincts within us. See that dragon holding a man in his hand and the little boat about to be crushed on the rocks down below? very fierce dragon. So Jung called this our primordial soul, and also the unconscious shadow aspect of the psyche. Now, it contains both good and bad. It's not all the dragon. It's the creative power of life, which can manifest either destructively or creatively. So please bear that in mind all the way through. The primordial soul is unconscious until it's called forth by fear or the drive to power. It then bursts through the fragile defenses of the conscious mind and can take possession of it, causing it to act as a predator, attacking whoever it sees as its prey. So I'm giving a definition of evil here because I think it has its origins in this unconscious predator-prey pattern of behavior in the primordial soul, in the deep unconscious. And it may be defined as the intention to inflict or the act of inflicting terror, suffering, humiliation, torture, or death on an individual or group of individuals. Now, Jung gave us a warning late in his life. He said, as at the beginning of the Christian era, so again today we're faced with the problem of the general moral backwardness of our species, which has failed to keep pace with our scientific and technical and social progress. And he said, we need more understanding of human nature, because the only real danger that exists is man himself. He is the great danger, and we are pitifully unaware of it. He said this in a talk with John Freeman in 1959. We know nothing of man, far too little. His psyche should be studied because we are the origin of all coming evil. I said this was a rather dark talk. We've had terrifying examples of the evil created by the predatory aspect of the primordial soul in the ideologies and mass hypnosis exercised by psychopathic individuals during the last century. Between them, they organized the murder of over 90 million people. They found plenty of bureaucrats like Eichmann who are willing to obey orders. That's always the thing that goes with psychopaths. They gather other psychopaths around them. Yes. So I'm going more deeply now into the predator-prey pattern in the primordial psyche. I don't know if any of you have seen the film Godzilla, but with Google's help, I found some lovely images of Godzilla. So here's the dragon again, coming up in our day. So I've tried to define this primordial predator-prey pattern as the instinct to kill, the will to dominate others, bestial cruelty, territorial expansion, terror or fear or the need to defend can come up through rage, through hatred, through jealousy, through greed, through tribal memories and customs as triggers. This is very important in the unconscious shadow. We can see this with the Sunni-Shia battle for power, which has gone on for 1,400 years, and the memory of Ali, the grandson of the Prophet, who was killed at Karbala in Iraq, it's still going on, this hatred and this enmity. So this is what comes from the unconscious shadow. And then we have things like FGM and murder of women for apostasy or whatever. It's absolutely horrific. And this all comes from very, very old customs and memories that we carry within the psyche. So here are three images of what the psyche can look like or become when it's taken over by the shadow aspect of the primordial soul. The first is a painting by Max Ernst from the Second World War. The second is an image of the Gorgon taken from the Greek myth of Perseus. Do you remember the Gorgon who turned everyone to stone who looked at her? And the third is an example of the current takeover of the Muslim mind by the shadow aspect of Islam. The Middle East is now in the grip of another devastating ideology, which could spread to the whole world. So wherever you have an ideology controlling men who want to dominate the world, or an individual in a position of power who has a sense of divine mission, you will have the danger of inflation and hubris, as well as a tremendous drive for power. And this applies not only to the Islamists and religious fundamentalists in general, but can also apply, I think, to any national leader who wields immense power and is unconscious of the dangers of grandiosity and inflation. Now here, you'll have to forgive me with this picture. I wasn't sure. I asked Scylla, should I put it in or not? Well, it doesn't want to show it.
I don't think it's there, actually.
Well, maybe it may come afterwards. Okay. Anyway, I'm afraid it was of Tony Blair. David's seen it years ago. But I mean, it was a cartoon I cut out of the Times, and it says, let's have God in politics, and he's got a long white beard, and he's sort of... So, I'm sorry, it may come up in a minute. But what I want to look at now is this, what I'm trying to explain, really. There is the collective shadow, the primordial soul, which is creative and destructive, both creative, you mustn't forget that. There's the personal shadow, which is the personal experience of our lives and traumas, imprinted beliefs that we've had put onto us. And there is the little tiny bit at the top, is our conscious mind. We don't know anything, relatively speaking, unless you're a psychotherapist. You don't know about this deeper level. Forgive me if I say that. And you have the mind possessed by the primordial shadow, so it comes up from the depths and takes possession of the conscious mind. Is that clear?
Yeah,
makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I think one needs a diagram like that, because when you talk about the unconscious, nobody knows what you're talking about. Okay, yeah, it is coming up next. I obviously forgot to change it over. Now, in the case of Tony Blair and George W. Bush, there was a sense of divine mission driving them. They knew nothing of the shadow aspect of their own psyche, let alone the shadow aspect of the Muslim psyche and its sense of collective identity. This inflation distorted their judgment about the dangers of invading Iraq and the mass psychosis and turmoil they would unleash, not to mention the fearsome dragon of ISIS, a dragon far more dangerous than Saddam Hussein, that now, with horrific barbarism, aims to establish a Sunni caliphate stretching from Syria right the way round to Algeria and including Turkey and Iran. It is unbelievable. They really do want to establish that. And this is the God inflation, if you like. So having got Tony Blair over, I've put here, this is from Andrew Powell, which he sent to The Guardian and another paper, and they didn't publish it. Andrew Powell is a psychiatrist who's a very distinguished member of the Psychiatric Association and a member of the network. So we're the greatest threat to the planet because as a species we're so unconscious. We're collectively driven by the biological imperatives of the limbic system, the fight or flight response, and are still geared to egocentric perception of threat. We're not able to see the threat we ourselves constitute to the planet and our species because we're just not aware of it. We're in the midst of the sixth great extinction, which is caused by us in what has been called the Anthropocene Age. By 2050, it's estimated that as many as half the animals and plants with whom we share the planet will have become extinct. Now, it's not entirely, you can't blame it all on us, because we didn't know. But we do know now, and people are trying to do something about it. Many, many thousands, including Scylla, my great friend here, is doing something about it. So here we come to Godzilla again. This fearsome dragon is an exact reflection of our unconscious shadow that is now released on the world in the form of terrorism and war and planetary devastation. And why, after 4,000 years of so-called civilization, are we still able to regress so easily into barbarism? Why are there still 50 million refugees from war, the same number as after the Second World War? Now I've got another Jung quote here. Now this has all come about, the state that we're in now, because consciousness, that little triangle at the top, has been torn from the bottom part of the triangle. There's no relationship between the top and the bottom. Consciousness, torn from its roots, possesses a Promethean freedom, but it also partakes of the nature of a godless hubris, with the assertion that nothing is greater than man and his deeds. God's powers have passed into our hands. The powers themselves are not evil, but in the hands of man, they are an appalling danger, in evil hands. Now, with nuclear fission, tremendous power was given into our hands. power that we are in no sense equipped to handle, morally speaking. The belief that matter is dead, rather than alive with spirit, allowed us to split the atom and develop a dangerous technology which is leaving lethal residues of radioactivity on the Earth from nuclear explosions. There have been over 2,000 nuclear explosions. And from the plutonium waste from nuclear reactors, which nobody talks very much about. There's 425 nuclear reactors now in the world, and more to 70 more being built. So it's enabled us to keep create ever more demonic weapons with which to perpetuate our addiction to war. And it's created a very dangerous situation for the whole planet and a very negative karma. Now we come to the second half. Alchemy gives us this image of killing the king, killing the old kind of consciousness that holds the world hostage. This will eventually involve dismantling or weakening the powerful and irresponsible elites who now control the resources of the planet in ever increasing efforts to do this. They want more and more control. Many thousands of people are now working out ways in which this weakening of these powerful elites can be achieved. But it's like David Goliath's situation. It's extraordinarily difficult. Much is being accomplished by online challenges to the established order. We can also identify the old king with an outworn image of spirit that needs to be relinquished in order for a new image to emerge from the depths of the soul. Just as we have to buy new clothes to replace worn-out ones, so an image of spirit that's long presided over the civilization may need to be discarded in order for spirit to be reborn in a new form. You can't keep God fixed like a plant in a pot. He gets pot-bound, has to break out and expand. Anyone who's a gardener will understand what I'm talking about. Okay, so we need a new story and we need a new concept of deity or spirit if we're to create a different kind of civilization. So I'd like now to turn to a few aspects of this new story, more cheerful. First of all, there needs to be a change in the relationship between the two great archetypal principles as reflected in this beautiful painting where Christ is crowning his mother. We're living now at the end of a great trajectory which has brought about the gradual separation or differentiation of our human species from nature, the development of self-awareness, and everything that we now define as human consciousness. But in the process, we've lost touch with the soul and the ancient sense of participation in a sacred cosmos. This story has been described as a heroic ascent to autonomy, but at the same time, a tragic fall from unity. It's a man called Richard Tarnas who said that. Yet we're now in the midst of a great awakening of the soul, one that could see the marriage of the masculine and feminine principles and the two long separated lunar and solar ways of knowing. And this marriage is prefigured in the 15th century in the many paintings of the Coronation of the Virgin. So to go with what Tuvi was telling me yesterday, this is really the awakening of the sleeping beauty. This is what's happening now on the planet. Once upon a time, the feeling for the sacredness of life and relationship with the cosmos was a deep instinct shared by the whole of humanity. Then, almost imperceptibly, it was lost. For centuries, a tremendous problem has been troubling the waters of the soul, and it is this. In a civilization which is patriarchal in organization and outlook, which has been structured for millennia by a male image of God presiding over religions and institutions created entirely by men, through no fault of their own, really, and by a polarizing mythology, because they didn't know what they were doing. Oh, now I've lost my place. And by a polarizing mythology which glorifies power, conquest, and the mastery of nature, how can the long-silenced voice of the feminine, the voice of the soul, be heard? There's no time now to listen to it anyway with all the technology that's going on and Facebook, which I don't belong to yet. And how can we begin to recognize once again the sacredness of the earth and the sacredness of the cosmos? How can we listen to that voice calling to us and the role we might play in a great cosmic drama if we were once again able to bring ourselves into a harmonious relationship with them? Now, you'll have to forgive me, those of you who are scientists, because I'm not a scientist, but I've just put a few things together that mean a great deal to me. First of all, I'm fascinated by the idea that 96% of the universe is invisible. Now, that means that 96% of us is invisible as well. All of us in this room. Where's the other 96%? Is it in a field of consciousness which is connecting us all to each other? We were talking at breakfast about the importance of meeting each other and talking to each other, engaging with each other. So I just put that question, where is the other 96%? Einstein said, "It's nothing short of a miracle that the modern methods of instruction have not entirely strangled the holy curiosity of inquiry. For this delicate plant, aside from stimulation, stands mainly in need of freedom. We must have the freedom to discuss and to talk, to challenge, and not to be bullied." That's the most important thing, not to be bullied by belief systems. We were bullied by the religious thing before, now we're bullied by the scientific reductionist thing. So, I think what's taking place now is an annunciation of a new birth in human consciousness. I think it's taking place in our time. And one of the major changes in the process now is that I think we're moving from the concept of a dead universe without meaning or purpose to the concept of a living universe in whose life we participate. So I'm giving you a few quotations to illustrate this new concept of reality, which I hope will spread out through the culture, particularly to children who are in the greatest need of it. And I wish David could be made Minister of Education because he would really accomplish fantastic things like he has in Scotland, now spreading to England as well, I hope.
Commonwealth.
Brilliant. Wonderful. So the universe is not a collection of objects, but is an inseparable web of vibrating energy patterns in which no one component has reality independently from the entirety. Included in the entirety is the observer. I think I cut that out of the Daily Telegraph about 25 years ago or something, and kept that bit of paper ever since. And I've given you here the image of the old flower of life, which was Egyptian, showing that everything was connected, and the new flower of life in a most beautiful crop circle from 2001, which appeared in Wiltshire, which is my favourite crop circle, that has 900 and something circles and could not have been made in a night. The entire universe is an interdependent system that is co-arising with everything else at each moment. In this co-arising process, we participate directly with the world beyond our physical body. The electromagnetic quantum vacuum is a form of light. It is an underlying sea of energy that permeates every tiny volume of space, from the emptiest intergalactic void to the depths of the Earth, the Sun, and our own bodies. Our world of matter is like the visible foam on top of a very deep ocean of light. Scientists now know that particles are non-locally connected with each other throughout space. Living things of all kinds are non-locally connected throughout a subtle field that scientists know exists, although they don't yet understand what it is or how it works. That could be dark matter. We don't know yet. There is but one force in the world, a single, unique current which passes through us and all things. It is this force which links up everything, animates everything, and this is the fundamental substance, again the idea of substance, of the universe. The universe is an undivided wholeness in flowing movement, from the great physicist David Bohm. Can you all see that from the back? Now, Ravi Ravindra is also a member of the network and has written a wonderful book called Science and the Sacred, and I've taken this quote from his book. He says the one central insight into truth to which all Indian wisdom points is the oneness of all that exists. This insight is not alien to other cultures, but in India, all the great sages again and again return to it. Although the truth is easily stated as all is one, the sages have also said that the realization of this truth in the core of one's being can take many lifetimes. And the realization of this truth is held to be the purpose of human existence. All art, philosophy, and science, if they are true, reflect this vision and further its realization. Funnily enough, I gave a talk about in April down in Devonshire, and Ravi was in the audience. I read this out, and he said, "Good God, did I say that?" That's really rather good. He'd completely forgotten. So Einstein said that the religion of the future will be a cosmic religion. It should transcend a personal God and avoid dogma and theology. Covering both the natural and the spiritual, it should be based on a religious sense arising from the experience of all things, natural and spiritual, as a meaningful unity. Wonderful quote, I think, that. Wonderful idea. I often think, is he around now? Could he help us? Could Jung help us? I feel they helped me with my book. Everybody helped me. Because I didn't write that book myself. It just came through me. It really did. Now, coming to the... I've got just one more page, I think. I'm going to come now, risking my neck in your presence, to what I have researched and think is... I won't say the truth, but I think it's the possibility. I think there are three orders of reality. There's the plane of Earth, which is denser material reality, moving probably at a lower vibrational rate. Those of you who are scientists will know probably better than me what I mean. Then there's the intermediary plane, which is absolutely vast, or many millions of dimensions, not just one or two, but vast, vast number of dimensions. And this is the world of soul, the intermediary world. And this is what we move into when we die. And there's the plane of pure light, beyond form, the plane of the angelic intelligences, the divine realm. And the light of that plane permeates all the others. So we are actually made of the substance of that light in our physical creation of our bodies. We are that, but we don't know it because we can't see the light. We can't see the web which connects us. Such a pity. But if we think about it, we may bring this nearer. We may bring that awareness closer to us and not have to live in this dark cave of Plato's for much longer. I really do feel that. Now, each of us has at least three bodies for these three orders of reality. We have the physical body, which we all know about. We have a soul body that we move into when we die, called by some a subtle or etheric body, and composed of much finer particles than our physical body, and attached to it by a silver cord at this very moment. This body is weightless and can move freely, and it can create through the heart and the imagination, enter telepathically. And finally, we have a spirit body or bodies called radiant or luminous or shining or starry. That's what the Egyptians called it, the starry body, composed of ever finer light particles that we enter as we move closer to the light of the divine ground, ultimately, I think, merging with it. So, with Kubler-Ross, I think that nothing is more important for our well-being than to know that when we die, we move into another reality that's as real and vitally alive as this one. Consciousness does not die with the death of the body. Consciousness is eternal. Now, if people knew that, they wouldn't fight to stay alive. They wouldn't kill people. There wouldn't be any point in killing people. It would change our whole understanding of what life is about. And I think it's utterly ridiculous that we've lived for 2,000 years in ignorance of all this, except for a few people who've passed it on. They've been known as the golden chain, the catena oro, catena d'oro, who've passed on this knowledge from generation to generation and kept it alive for us today. And we owe them a great cheer of thanks for having done this, often being burnt at the stake or as I certainly was, or killed or strangled or whatever, because they had this knowledge. And the church didn't want it to be known to the wider public, because it would have freed the public from the control of the church. So, I've got a beautiful image of a bridge here. I think we need to build a bridge between the visible and invisible dimensions of reality. I think we need to expand our view to the distant horizon that beckons us to understand far more than we do at present, and to break through the firewall created by the dogmatic statements of reductionist science that limits this expansion. So I think that we can bring together the visible and the invisible worlds quite consciously, every day, thinking about it. Take somebody who's died or somebody you respect from the past and connect with that person. Ask them to come into your life to speak to you. So I created this diagram of the sacred marriage, really, which leads to the conscious participation in an ensouled universe. I think the universe is asking us now to develop stellar consciousness and to reconnect the divine spark of our consciousness with the invisible soul of the cosmos. The evolution of human life on this planet has followed a very slow gradient of ascent over millions of years, from unconsciousness to self-consciousness and then to awakened consciousness, which is, I think, what's happening in many of us now. The whole of humanity suffers because the increase of consciousness is so slow, and the radical transformation of consciousness that is needed to diminish human suffering and ignorance is so difficult to implement. We can assist this evolutionary process by helping to transform our consciousness from lead into gold, as the alchemists did, transforming blind, unconscious drives into responses that protect and serve life. Many different fields, medical fields, scientific fields, cosmological fields, there's so many things that we can engage in with our gifts that we have. The responsibility of this is huge, but I think that as a species we're capable of rising to it. We have it in us. Because we have that divine spark in us, we can respond to the call of the cosmos and rise to it in whatever way we can. So to end, I've got this beautiful picture. I think that every atom of life interacts with every other atom. I think that none of us is truly separate from the other. I think we all participate in the great field of the soul, or the web of life which connects us to all life on earth and all life in the cosmos. And this realization is, to me, the higher vision that's being birthed on this planet. So thank you all very much.
Well, thank you so much, Anne. A really inspiring talk. Yes, I think we did have to grit our teeth through the first half, but the second was so wonderful that it explodes within us and leads us into the future. So who would like to ask some questions?
We have some mics.
Who'd like to take a mic round? John in the front.
I may say I'm not very good at answering questions because I have a short-term memory, so I don't often remember the question when I'm trying to think of the answer.
Thank you very much, and this is John Capp. And mind-bogglingly comprehensive, articulated.
No, it's okay.
No, you can do it sitting down. It's okay.
You managed to articulate such a huge amount in so short. This is basically very pedantic. The only thing I would change is that you say you have to die in order to realize. Now, I have a feeling since I started meditating of getting exactly what you... In other words, a sense of my own soul. I sometimes put my hand above my head to perhaps somewhere where the eighth chakra should be, to see myself, I hope as others see me, but also to see that, to get a glimpse of this oneness between all of us. So that would be the only pedantic, tiny amendment that I would have to what I thought was a fantastic presentation.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, but I think I said that I asked all of you to connect, to be aware that you have this 96% around you. That's what I meant, really. But I agree that we don't have to wait till we die. It's here and now. We need to connect with it. Thank you very much.
Yes.
I want to talk about the nasty bits, the first half of the talk, which I feel was very, very important on the shadow. I see everywhere around me people who are totally unconscious of their own shadow and, whose lives are basically ruled by that unconscious part of themselves, which when it's released on a national level, you get the Hitlers and you get the Godzillas and everything else. Do you have anything to say about getting to know and integrate that side of us? Because we don't have religions anymore. We don't have systems. The new and upcoming, self-help systems nowadays tend to ignore that part of us. Do you have something people who would like to get to know and integrate that side of themselves?
Well, it takes a lifetime to know one's shadow, I will say that. So it's a long work. And, as a child, you're told not to touch something or not to do something. That's the beginning of the training, to be aware that there's something that one needs to be aware of, a pattern of behavior that is not acceptable, say. But when it gets to the level of national governments, it's completely out of control by then. And unfortunately, there's nothing in the media. I mean, the media would be fantastic. Maybe the network could do something with this to teach people how to be aware of the shadow. It really you need to become aware of where you're being taken over by rage or fear. Fear is one of my problems. Driving here yesterday, I drove Scylla mad, saying, like that. So that was my shadow taking over. And finally said, shut up. So one just has to be aware of the things that are bothering you in your relationships, because that is where the shadow will show up, with your partner, with your children, when you lose your temper, when you say, I'm going to divorce you because I can't stand you anymore. It may be that you're projecting your shadow onto your partner and she onto you, and that needs to be discussed. And Jung spoke about something called the transcendent function, which is actually the field between two people or different people. If you can become aware and hold the field there between whatever you're arguing about or discussing, that field will bring you a third thing of reconciliation or a third thing of insight. And that is what actual therapy, that's what I would do as a therapist. I would bring that field into consciousness with the client and allow it to bring things up and in its own time, not forcing things. So there's a huge work to be done. I don't know how it can be done, but little by little, we could do it by just using the word shadow and using it to apply to politicians, making them more aware of it, of when they're, like, for instance, when Blair was urging everyone to go into Syria, and thank God Parliament said no. But otherwise, there would have been another mess, much, much worse. So there is awareness in the collective of this country. There is an awareness of where things need to stop and to tell politicians. So that is an awareness of the shadow. Okay, I may think I've answered that.
Thank you.
Hello. Yes. Hello.
Sorry?
Hi.
Where?
In the front.
In the front. Okay, got you.
Well, many thanks for that brilliant talk. Thank you very much. I have one question about the shadow as well. Is this something that is being created because of circumstances?
Sorry, because of what?
Of circumstances. Somebody is worried or somebody is concerned about something.
Yes.
uncertainties and things like that. Even when a baby is born and cries, why? Yeah. Because there is something that is disturbing the baby. So is the shadow, what we call a shadow, something that is being created because of circumstances as we live along?
I think so, yes. And I think it's been, in a historical sense, it's been created right the way through this 4,000-year-long period, because it's been a period of non-stop war, really. There's hardly a period with no war. So, but the shadow is also, because I said there's positive, creative things also in that deep unconscious, is the warning, perhaps, that when the baby is crying, it needs food. So you pay attention. So that's a warning thing coming from the instinct, really, saying, look out, you know, something needs attention here. And so you can look at it in many different aspects. You can look at it in looking out for the positive warning thing, which is helping you to see something that you don't see. And you can look at it in the other way, in which something that you're not aware of, which is really what the Eastern people call karma. And this is the fate we bring with us from the past by what we've done in the past. And then we face the results in the present. And we go along the same path, creating yet more karma, bad karma. So if one can say, look, I'm not going to create any more bad karma, I'm going to stop this pattern, then you are really giving your insight into the working of the shadow, and you're freeing yourself from its power.
It's a matter of defining, really, but
yeah,
it's not so easy to do so.
No, it's very difficult.
And you also mentioned dark matter. What would that mean?
Nobody knows what dark matter is yet.
We've got a physicist here, but it's, yes, they themselves don't know.
I don't think they know.
They cannot see it.
Okay, right at the back there.
Yes. Thank you. I can follow your line of thinking. What you're saying is we have to reconnect to the all.
Yes.
But then on the first page, the bottom line, I know there's a lot of people in the world who think the all is called Allah.
Well, that's to give
a name.
And
we see that, or you see that as a threat or a thing. I see that as a lot of people who are looking for the all. And to honor that in that religion would make our fear about them different. Islamic people are not terrorists or crazy people. They try to look for exactly what you look for,
of course,
all.
Of course they do.
They try to connect to something, and I think if we would honor that, we would not see them as a threat.
But we don't see them as a threat as a whole. We see the Islamists as a threat, the ones who are really threatening now, because they've split off the image of deity from what they're doing. They think that God approves, Allah approves of what they're doing, and they're doing it in the name of Allah. Now, the other Muslims don't agree with that, but they're very quiet. They don't speak up enough to say we condemn that behavior, and that's what's missing. If they did speak up, and if we had an imam come on television with Jon Snow on Channel 4 and say this is utterly wrong, and it is wrong, it's that the Prophet would never have condoned this, because he said that every human life is precious, and we're all one life, and if you take away one life by killing it...
But what you're saying is that is the shadow.
The shadow is the behaviour.
What is beyond that is the need to connect to the all.
Yes, of course, but if you distort the need to connect with the all by the inflation of speaking in the name of the all and acting in a destructive and dangerous way in the name of the all, then you're actually betraying the all.
Yeah,
anyway, I think
it's our job to look beyond.
Okay.
See why they do it, and why still 700 million people in the world pray 5 times a day and honor Allah.
Because there's a need to connect. Of course there's a need to connect. But why, equally, do they perpetuate the split between the Shia and the Sunni, leading to ever more deaths? Why do they do that?
And oh,
no, I don't want an answer.
The answer is very simple. Because it's an eternal struggle between the magical, which is the Shia, and the anti-magical, which is the Sunni. The same between Catholics and Protestants. It's an age-old struggle.
Okay.
The magical and the anti-magical.
Thank you very much.
Okay, let's move on. Right.
Can you hear me? Oh, yeah. Come and do it here. As a small contribution to the improving of things and bringing in dragons again, recently I bought a nice little DVD for my grandchildren, which is called How to Train Your Dragon. And I was absolutely delighted, as they were, because what about show first how the conflict between the imaginary Vikings and the dragon proceeds. And then somebody makes friends with the dragon, and then they all make friends with the dragon, and they find that the dragons have been forced to go and attack the humans because, to provide food for the enormous dragon that was hidden in a cave. That's the shadow.
That's a lovely story. And actually, that could be used so much in education in the nicest possible way. And mustn't forget the dragon guards the treasure.
Yes, exactly.
And that's very important to remember.
Yes.
What I feel that it's very important to remember is that each spirit is created by that ultimate level of consciousness that we call God. And that ultimate level of consciousness gives every spirit free will of choice. God does not dominate us. It is our fear and the responsibility of making decisions that causes the problem. And that problem arises through fear, where fear means I must take control. And I think that we are entering a wonderful phase at the moment in the history of this planet, because I think things are really opening up and people are beginning to look beyond being chained to the past.
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right.
Yes.
Change to the past is a very good metaphor there, I think.
My name is Sarita Brown, and I'm just coming back to the issue of Islam, because the inner meaning, the esoteric meaning of Allah, is the one breath. And this is such an exquisite inspiration for all of us at this time. And there is so much wisdom in the mysticism that is beyond Islam, but rooted originally, historically, around the time of Islam. For example, when we're talking about the alchemy and going beyond the individual, there's a very famous saying, die before death and resurrect now. And I have to say that your talk is just so inspiring, Anne, and it will live with me, and I will be spreading it out to others. And there's one thing, which is that image of the Islamists. And I think that for us to perpetuate that kind of image is perpetuating our shadow. Okay. And our shadow has created, if you think of what we did to Iraq with the sanctions, where children did not have pencils in school. Hospital administrators did not have paper to send letters on. We were destroying an Islamic culture which was really flourishing and very, very high, for all that, you know, there was this dictator. And so I would like us to claim our own shadow in this and to recognize the spirit of Islam as if Christianity is to find that harmony, that note, that deeper note that unites all.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Sarita, for saying that. I think that you've brought through the quintessence of the true Islam, and that is very important. And it's also so important that, as you said, the sanctions, it's not only the sanctions, it's the depleted uranium that was used in the weapons, which has destroyed the lives of thousands of children. And the killing.
Yeah, Muslim.
Yeah, I know, and 4 million displaced, and it's just terrible, and we just cannot see that we've done that. Anyway, thank you.
Yes. I was going to say exactly what that lady's just said. So I was just going to say that I think at one point you said, well, we don't have religions anymore. It's all, it seemed a bit dismissive of religions. But
no, I didn't say religions. I said Christianity, the weakening of Christianity.
Sorry, excuse me. Yeah. But yes, do you not think that we could possibly utilise the structures we already have? So you were saying we were trying to reconnect with the light. Isn't that not what religions have all been trying to do? And isn't the answer maybe to more interfaith work and getting all the religions talking together and saying, yes, oh, we're actually trying to do the same thing here? And it's almost we've got that as a structure and as a path in all those religions. Can't we utilise that? And isn't that not one way we can get towards the oneness altogether, rather than throwing the baby out with the bathwater?
I quite agree with you, but for years now, all through my lifetime, there have been ecumenical councils between the different religions. There have been deep understanding between scholars, but it doesn't reach the people. And this is the problem, how to reach the people, how to have the true teaching of religion, which is in all the religions, how to bring that forth and not have it connected with the political system, which has distorted, really, the meaning of the religion. But I agree with you.
Yeah, it's working.
Hello, yeah. Hello, it's Melvin Banks here. Wonderful to hear your words. What I wonder, as well as about all the shadow and the things that we could talk about, is what we can do to bring this emerging consciousness into being. And a lot has been said, which I think we need to emphasise, about the feminine nature that's emerging and wants to bring this in with this quality. And within that, I think there's an important role to recognise how the masculine can support that. Because I think we talk about the patriarchal and the demonic parts of the masculine that destroyed this, but we need to somehow find a way that the masculine can support this energy in a way that still feels he has this warrior and this beautiful energy in there without having to subvert it to war and to the old masculine traits that were presented. And we don't have a model for that. And I wonder how the masculine can really come alive like the old Red Indians or the Aborigines and showed this quality of the spirit without destruction and not having to use it to dominate the feminine. And I wonder if you could say something, how the masculine could bring this model back and how the masculine in society can support that with the feminine.
Well, you actually expressed it absolutely beautifully. So I don't know what I can add to that. But it's a new kind of warrior spirit which is directed towards helping the planet rather than towards territorial ambition or whatever. And the feminine quality in both men and women is to care, to cherish, to look after, to protect. So it's all that. It's in the masculine. Men have done it for thousands of years, looking after their families and their children. So it's innate in the male psyche. But it gets just distorted. And you see in the media that competition, the rivalry, everything is blown up out of all proportion, even in football, which is our one religion in a way, apart from tennis. So I think it is coming into being. It has been over my lifetime, definitely, utterly changed. I mean, my father was a very fierce patriarchal military man, but he mellowed over his life, and he became a healer at the age of 80. So, you know, things can change, and if one person like you is conscious, you spread that through the people you know, through the families you know, through your own family, and you bring it into the community through what you are. And then other men will do this too, and I think that warrior thing will be transformed. Well, you have Nelson Mandela as the most prime example of this, or Desmond Tutu. We have examples, if we can remember them. And so that's what I would say, but I would thank you so much for saying that.
Thank you very much, Anne, for a very beautiful and eloquent talk. My question is this, that human beings who like to think of themselves as so very clever, have not learnt the lesson after the First World War, which it's very much in the news. How stupid a race can they exist that they start another world war within 20 years? I mean, this is not funny. I mean, it may sound it. That I've often reflected that the brain that we use to build our computers and our aeroplanes and space explorations and nuclear reactors and all the other things, that brain is totally useless at solving the problem of peace. So my question is, what kind of a radical mind does one need to inculcate to solve the problem of peace? Because the mind that we use now is patently not equipped to do this. The mind that can build all this wonderful technology and all the rest of it has not solved how we can live peacefully. So what kind of mind should we be alluding to us?
Well, thank you very much. It's a very difficult question to answer, the most difficult so far. I think that we have to reconnect with the heart as a civilization. This is what I meant by bringing together the two kinds of consciousness, because until we do that, we're stuck in the solar way of thinking. And I would say to get with the First World War, that was started quite deliberately by the politicians. We needn't have gone into that war. But with the Second World War, we had to go in because Hitler was such a terrible threat. We couldn't have him really controlling everything. He was utterly, utterly dangerous.
Always emphasize the role of the heart in consciousness, not just the brain.
Yeah, absolutely. But you have to bring... You can with children, again, with stories. You can make them more aware of their heart. You can teach them to breathe through their heart. You can teach them to hold the dragon in their heart. All sorts of things that could be done with education. And that would, in the next two or three generations, that would work its way through. But as for the moment, we simply have to control politicians with mass movements and marches or whatever. And online petitions, like Avaaz, which is a wonderful organization, which has 30 million followers now. That has clout. Okay.
Yeah. And it's
over here.
Over here.
And over here.
Okay.
Thank you very much for an amazing presentation, and Sarita, for you too. You touched on so many important things. The shadow and the possession of the shadow is something that is of particular interest to me. I've been looking at that for many years, and I think the point that you make of what happens when we are possessed by the shadow and we are completely unaware of it at a personal and collective level is fundamental, absolutely fundamental. What for me, what really set me thinking is my own experience in my own life of the synchronicities that have taken me to where I am, and Jung's philosophy is so useful in understanding that. And looking at the history, as you portray the history of the Western, the Western history, which now pervades the whole of the planet with its values and philosophies and principles and so on, what do you think is the spiritual narrative in terms of our evolution as a human species? In other words, the comparison that I'm making is of our personal lives, the synchronicities that, like with your father, he started in one kind of mindset and ended in a different mindset. And I think we all have experience of the same thing. When we look back at our lives, we can see how it takes us to where we are now. And for me, the personal and the collective are reflective of each other. So what do you think is the spirit, is the narrative of the evolution of humanity to where we are now, where we are facing this emergence, as you say, of a new consciousness, but at the same time facing a very, very, very important obstacle, which is the literalism
of the population that is, I mean, whether it's the Islamists or whether it's the fundamentalist Christians, the evangelics, or even the materialists, the scientific, it's this kind of literalism which discards
the deeper.
Yeah. But it's still part of the collective. Of the story. Yeah.
I don't know. I just have a feeling that, like you mentioned synchronicity, there have been so many synchronicities in the guidance of my life and people that I know, that I think one simply has to trust that, both in a personal sense, and that something is happening in the collective as well, and bringing the synchronicities in, which people will probably notice. What could stop us in our tracks with this literalism? I just don't know. I expect it could be some catastrophe, but it may not need to be, because if enough people wake up to this understanding, wake up to where we've been going wrong, which I think there's a deep sense in the general populace, they have this awareness that something is not right, and we're out of gear somehow with where we ought to be. And I think that just with the number of people here, how many are we, 50, 80 people, spreading out through our own lives, watching these things, and always asking for help, like people used to ask the God for help. We ask the universe to guide us and to give us the opportunity of changing these things, however small they may be in the village or wherever. These things, I think, so much has changed. I'm now 82. When I was 20, none of this existed, none of this new thinking. There was logical positivism in Oxford, it was a dreadful philosophy. And I thought, my God, what am I living in? I don't want to live in this sort of society. But it's changed hugely, and I think largely as a result of Jung's influence, because he brought back the soul, and the word soul was never mentioned, really. Nobody knew what the soul was, or even if one had one, what it was. So that is a huge change, and I think that does give one hope for the future. And also, I think from the evolution of consciousness point of view, I think we had to develop the conscious mind and the conscious ego. We probably had to turn against the unconscious and nature, because nature was the great maw that would swallow us up if we didn't hang on to this little bit of consciousness that we had. That was the fear. That was the fear of the theologians. That's why they put such an emphasis on, on laying down exactly what had to be believed in case they got swallowed up by this great dragon of the unconscious again. So I think the 4,000-year-long phase of building the ego has been necessary. But now, as Richard Tarnas says, we need to reconnect with the feminine. And if only one could get a foothold on the media, one one could do so much. So that's my answer to you. Not to worry too much, that it is happening, and happening in a huge way since the internet, because we can all connect more with each other.
Who controls the media?
Well, at the moment, we God knows, but Google, presumably.
Jeanette.
Now, there's one person.
This is not so much a question, but an observation on getting to know your shadow. I don't know whether anybody has read Karen Armstrong's biography of Muhammad based on historical records, but it is a story about a man becoming aware of how his shadow is driving him. And at the end of his life, he renounces violence, tells his followers to do that, and tells his enemies that if they come and attack him, he will not resist with violence. And that is what enables him to be invited back into Mecca. So, ironically, but also very interestingly, the actual story of Muhammad is a great story of a man becoming aware of his own shadow and acting upon it.
That's very helpful, actually. Yes, thank you. Fascinating. Didn't know that.
Beata.
I have to go back two or three questions. When we talked about the need for the masculine to support the feminine in its emergence, now I believe in that card of the tarot which shows the hanged man, that sometimes we have to put things upside down to find the answer. And my question is it possible that perhaps the masculine element within the feminine has to be evoked in a peaceful and creative and caring fashion to allow the feminine principle to find its rightful place, which it hasn't had for a very long time.
I think I would absolutely... I can just use my own life as an example, because I've had a fearful...
microphone.
Sorry, I've had a fearful negative animus working against everything that I've tried to do, a negative male side of myself, saying everything you do is stupid, ridiculous, just shut up, nobody will listen to you, you can't write a book, you can't do anything at all. I've had to fight against that, transform that masculine voice, which came from my father, I mean, the critical father, and all the critical fathers going back, they were all warriors going back in the past. So to bring that animus into a gentle masculine who helps me and who helped me write that book, because he gave me the discipline, the continuity, and all that sort of thing. So that can happen in the culture as a whole once people understand it, that many women have this critical inner voice which stops them doing things they want to do, and men have a critical feminine voice which says, you're going to make yourself ridiculous if you say that in front of your friends, you know, or your peers, or scientists, for instance, can't speak up because they'll lose their job. So all this is part of the transforming process, but I know that as a woman, I've had to develop the masculine side to be able to do what I'm doing now today, to speak with authority, but I hope not imposing things on people, not controlling or putting things onto people, but to develop the gentleness of the masculine that gentleman spoke about, which is there intrinsically and just needs to have this superficial layer that we've absorbed over the last few millennia, which is fear of the church, fear of speaking out, guilt over being wrong. All that is part of our programming, and that has to be gradually dissolved or thrown out or eradicated, not eradicated really, but just left aside. And then the true masculine and the true feminine, which is both of them about caring, protecting, loving, cherishing, and about compassion. All the religions speak about compassion. So I would say that this is happening, I think, within individuals. I mean, in your life, I'm sure you've seen that change as well.
Except when I was 12 years old, I was told by the neighbor's son that girls can't play chess. And I still can't play chess properly.
Okay, two more questions. One and then two. Marilyn, you finish. Oh. You next.
Sorry, what do you want to
do? Oh. Hello, Anne.
Hello.
Thank you very much. That was very moving and inspiring. And actually, my question has become a bit superfluous after what you just said. But I was thinking that the Dalai Lama said a couple of years ago, arousing much controversy, that Western women would save the world. Mm. I wonder what your thoughts are about that, although I think I know.
Well, that cheered me up no end. I put it in my book. It's there. He also said meditation. One very interesting thing, he was asked, what should we do in the way of meditation? He said, see what's wrong with the world and then go and do something about it. And that's meditation. And very interesting, I thought. But as far as Western women will save the world, well, they have to develop themselves first if they're going to save the world. They can't just go out there and tell everybody what to do. It has to be a gentle way of doing it, as well as an authoritative way, but very gentle. And I hope it does happen.
Marilyn?
Yeah, I'm always worried about, you know, for me it seems the real war is between what I feel is rather a veneer of civilization and civilized behavior and animal instinct. I mean, from an evolutionary point of view, the most powerful selectables in evolution are procreation and survival. And we're here today because our ancestors, you know, had this incredibly powerful need to survive. And I think that our minds, our consciousness, is concerned with the survival of the being, or in the case of human beings, whoever the being considers itself to be, the survival of my religion or my football team or whatever. And constantly, I think, historically, we see people living in harmony and suddenly some great division between Christianity and Islam appears and and Abel's killing each other, and one despairs about the power of this instinct to survive versus the level of individual, how we want to be kind and so on. And I just think for myself, I might lay down my life rather than kill somebody else, but if somebody threatened my children, I would go to war. And we have the problem now, there used to be boundaries between tribes, societies, nations, civilizations, with spaces between. But with globalization and resources running out, you know, as I say, the seven deadly sins are activated by fear of survival, all of them. You know, if I'm not going to survive, I'm going to kill, I'm going to steal, I'm going to stockpile resources. What I'm saying is, I don't really know how to resolve this conflict between fear of surviving and being kind and compassionate and good, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm.
Well, it is a very big dilemma, and we are programmed, particularly since the misinterpretation of Darwin, but we're programmed about the survival of the fittest. But I think, Marilyn, one should remember that life has actually evolved through collaboration. And long before the tribes, I mean at the amoebic level, at the cellular level.
Within a tribe, not between tribes.
Really?
Well, within a tribe, of course, collaboration, service, sacrifice, altruism are very important selectables for survival of the tribe. There are very different selectables between tribes.
Yeah, but I'm thinking about the whole evolutionary process of life on the planet, that it had to be not only fighting for survival, but also collaboration, working together with little tiny units which then expanded into bigger ones and connected with the next lot of things. There's a wonderful book called Earth Dance by Elizabeth Sartorius, who's a biologist, and I would recommend that book to everybody because it gives this picture of collaboration. And also I think we have to remember the image of the butterfly and how the chrysalis turns into the butterfly. The chrysalis doesn't know it's going to turn into the butterfly. The butterfly isn't there thinking that I'm going to be a butterfly, but it happens. And I think we have to look at the evolutionary process as the chrysalis becoming the butterfly and carry that image of hope, really. Otherwise, if we're just going to fight it out to the death, we might as well give up now.
Well, I think that's a wonderful point to stop, in fact. there's just one thing I'd like to do, first of all, is to ask the network, you're the network, how many of you really feel that when you die, your consciousness is obliterated, finished, that's the end? Well, that's only one of you. Okay, so clearly you're all chrysalises turning into butterflies. I think, Anne, one of the most important things that you said for me was this whole idea of codependent arising, the fact that the actual moment of perception creates what is. In other words, we're co-creators of the reality in which we are, and it's a very fundamental property of the universe. So I think that for me was essential. I loved seeing the dragon come back. Yes, I think that I have a lot of dragons in there that need to be got out. So it was a fantastic talk. And the book clearly is a summation of your life's understanding and your life's work. And we see this really in...
You've known me for a long time.
Yes.
You've known me for a long time, so you've seen my development really through other books.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And so that's one reason why I recommend that we should all get a copy of it. But also, I'd like to thank you for your humanity, your understanding, and what you bring to life in general, and the way that you have the capacity to change things. So, Anne, thank you very much indeed.